Today's speaker is Linda Hall. Linda is the co-author of EPA's 2003 Water Quality Trading Policy and has worked as EPA's trading coordinator for 4 years. In today's webcast, Linda will share an informative overview of trading and address your questions on this innovative water quality management approach. Good afternoon, Linda.
Thank you. Welcome, everyone. Thanks a lot for joining us. We have a packed agenda here for you for the next couple of hours, and I'm going to start just on slide 2 to review what we'll cover today, although I will say it won't necessarily be in the order listed. It'll vary a little bit, but we will get to cover all these topics, starting with sort of a basic overview of what is trading, what are some of the ways it's been used in environmental programs, how does trading work, especially in the water context, including how do you determine an appropriate size for trading boundary, how do you define what the credit is or commodity is that's being traded, identifying buyers and sellers, etc. I will walk through a couple project examples, and then we're very fortunate to have Sonia Bjorn Hansen from Oregon DEQ, who will be taking us through a third example of a very innovative trading project that she's been working on there. We'll continue with looking more generally at what are some of the watershed conditions that make trading a favorable approach for meeting water quality goals. It's not a silver bullet. It doesn't work everywhere. And we've learned a few things about where trading is more likely to be successful and less likely to be successful. We'll take a look at some of the overall benefits and challenges of trading. And then continuing on slide 3, we'll review all the functions that any trading program has to provide for, including, of course, Clean Water Act compliance, connecting buyers and sellers, tracking trades, and providing information to the public. The next bullet is Sonia's presentation. As I said, we're a little out of order on these first two slides. And then we'll give an overview of where trading is occurring now. And then at the end, just look a little bit towards the future and what are some of the more exploratory areas where trading is going. And then leave you with a number of resources where hopefully you can get some more information. So moving to slide 3, what is trading? There are a number of phrases listed on this slide, which you can just read over. Economists and students of trading, you know, will tell you there's a different definition for every phrase that's on this slide and nuances that separate them. But by and large, all of these practices, whether it's mitigation, wetlands mitigation, effluent trading, air emissions trading, are a form of the general practice of trading, which is a practice that allows environmental goals to be met by allowing flexibility in where pollutants control actions are taken and by whom. On slide 5, and we're going to explore that a little in more detail in a couple of slides, but slide 5 just shows you a number of the many ways in which trading has already been used or is being used now to achieve environmental goals. Some of the first trading took place during the 1980s, when EPA established caps on and eventually elimination of lead and gasoline. Trading among automakers was actually used to achieve those caps in a more cost-effective way and meeting EPA's deadlines. Probably one of the most famous applications of the cap and trade concept is the acid rain program established in the 1990s, which has reduced 10 million tons per year of sulfur dioxide at savings that are estimated to be $1.5 to $3 billion compared to what it would have been without a cap and trade approach. Other approaches, other applications of sort of the trading or offset concept, wetlands mitigation, offsetting permitted wetland impacts that are unavoidable. Some states are pursuing a trading or offset approach to stream bank restoration and endangered species habitat in California. If a development impacts habitat for endangered species, a developer must secure suitable habitat and conserve such habitat in perpetuity in order to try to achieve a no-net loss, if you will, of species habitat. North Carolina is taking a similar approach with stream bank restoration. Any project that its Department of Transportation undertakes that erodes or otherwise negatively impacts a riparian area has to be offset by restoration of a similar size area in the watershed. Greenhouse gas reduction, if and when global efforts advance to reduce greenhouse gases in an aggressive way. Many people believe that a cap and trade approach will be ideally situated for that because greenhouse gases are, in fact, a global pollutant. It doesn't matter so much where the controls take place as long as they do take place. And finally, last but of course not least, is what we're here to talk about today, which is water quality trading. And the next slide delves a little deeper into sort of the definition of trading in a watershed context. So water quality trading is a management approach to improve water quality. That's its reason for being, is to help achieve water quality goals. And as I mentioned before, it is suited to particular water quality challenges. So it does not work everywhere, and we'll have a lot of time to explore where it does and doesn't work, at least based on experience to date. Trading is based in market or economic principles in that trading allows sources that have higher pollutant control costs to purchase environmentally equivalent pollutant reductions from another source at lower cost. That is kind of the essence of trading, that it provides flexibility in where and by whom pollutant control actions are taken. It does not change the environmental goal or the cap that is set. And then finally, trading is voluntary, but it is not a departure from a regulatory approach. Sometimes people refer to trading as an alternative to, quote, command and control. It is, in fact, a tool for achieving Clean Water Act goals, regulations, and water quality standards. And in that sense, it is completely integrated into the Clean Water Act structure. And in fact, EPA's 2003 water quality trading policy was primarily about describing how trading could occur in a way that's consistent with the Clean Water Act. The next slide sort of continues our definition discussion of trading. I'm going to walk through how, in a general way, trading works. And then in the next slide, we'll look at, on slide 8, we're on slide 7 now. I'm sorry, on slide 8, we'll look at, slide 7 covers trading generally, and then slide 8 will cover how trading usually unfolds in a water quality trading context. But in general, trading works by a cap or a limit being placed on the total amount of the pollutant that can be released from all sources, and identifying a time frame in which that cap will be met. So this is essential. This is a threshold condition for trading, as we say, in that it isn't going to happen unless this cap, or as we sometimes call it, a driver, is in place to make the reductions happen and provide an incentive, basically, for trading. Once the cap is set, each source receives an allocation, which is basically an authorization to release a given amount of pollutant that is consistent with whatever the applicable environmental laws and regs are. So in the water case, it would be an amount consistent with the TMDL or water quality standards. The total of the allocations will sum to the cap, basically. And then sources meet their allocation by in a traditional scenario, they would meet them by making all the necessary reductions on site. And in a trading scenario, and you can still have sources that do that in a trading scenario, but the key is that trading allows sources that wish to meet their allocation by buying credits from sources that have reduced pollutants below their own allocation. And this is an important point. How are credit sources can buy credits to help achieve their allocation. But how are those credits created? They're created by other sources reducing the pollutant below their own allocation, what we sometimes call surplus reductions. And it is only those extra, if you will, reductions that can be made available as credits that another source can use to meet its allocation. We'll see, you'll see that illustrated, I think, as we go through the examples. On slide 8, in a water context, the cap that we talk about is often a total maximum daily load or other consensus water quality goal. It isn't always a TMDL in the Chesapeake Bay, for example. The states and stakeholders there have agreed to tributary caps that are sufficient to achieve the water quality standards in the bay. So it can happen through a consensus goal. But most often we have seen that the driver, if you will, or the cap for trading in the water context is a TMDL. And as many of you know, I'm sure, the TMDL establishes a pollutant budget that is sufficient to achieve water quality standards. The way that budget, if you will, is formatted is that point sources receive individual waste load allocations. That is, each facility that has an NPDES permit receives a waste load allocation. And the waste load allocation is implemented via their NPDES permit through water quality-based effluent limits that are consistent with water quality standards. For non-point sources in a TMDL, as you're well aware, non-point sources are not regulated under the Clean Water Act. They do, however, receive load allocations in a TMDL. Load allocations differ from waste load allocations in that they are much more general. Load allocations apply generally to a general category of land use or pollutant-producing activity, so agriculture as a whole may get a load allocation or forestry. Again, of course, the load allocations are not enforceable under the Clean Water Act. One reason some people are excited about trading is that it can be an incentive. It can provide an incentive in watersheds to achieve the load allocation portion of the TMDL and bring more non-point sources to the table in reducing pollutant loads. If through trading you can provide incentives to landowners to not only meet their load allocation, but again to go below that load allocation, which is what would need to happen for credits to be available for sale, for use, then especially in watersheds that are impaired by both point and non-point sources, we may have a better chance of getting to water quality standards there. Moving to slide 9, continuing in how trading works, in a typical TMDL scenario, again, every point source is responsible for meeting its waste load allocation, and the non-point sources, in general, don't have a federal obligation to meet the load allocation, but may be given money to implement DMPs. In a trading scenario, point sources have the option of exchanging credits to meet their waste load allocation. And this exchange of credits between buyers and sellers is trading. Buyers of credits will be those that have higher pollutant control costs and want to secure pollutant control, pollutant reductions at lower costs. And suppliers or sellers of credits will have those lower costs and therefore have an ability to make reductions at lower cost and make those available to the buyers. In water quality trading tends to take different forms. In the trading literature, there are a lot of different ways of defining trading formats and approaches. At EPA, we tend to do it based on the basic division in the Clean Water Act between point and non-point sources, as well as on the scale that the trading occurs in. And the next couple slides will illustrate that. And then we'll get into a couple of examples. Actually, I'm still on slide 9. And that is, so the basic types of trading are point source trades. So these would be trades among facilities that have an NPDES facility, that have an NPDES permit. Could happen between two point sources, or as we'll see in an example later, between as many as 70 or 80 point sources. Often, this is implemented via a group NPDES permit that is just for the pollutant that is being traded. So a permit that covers 79 facilities for total nitrogen is one we'll see in the example we're going to cover. Second general area of trades in water are non-point source trades. So obviously the point source is always going to be the buyer of the credits because they're the ones that have to achieve their waste load allocation or their water quality-based effluent limit. So in a point non-point source trade, typically we're looking at a point source buyer, but buying from buying pollutant reductions basically from a nearby landowner, say, or a nearby forestry operation. We have had several point non-point source trades, about 10 or so, I think, at least. But so far, at least these trades in the U.S. have been limited to offsets for a single facility. So one NPDES permittee wants to expand their discharge, but the water segment they're on is already impaired. They have to get an offset, and they secure it from a local landowner. The third type of trading would take that model that I just described and expand it on a watershed scale. So this would be point non-point source trading, but with numerous point source buyers and numerous non-point source sellers of credits, and there are a number of such programs under development now. So the next slide, slide 10, just gives you sort of a schematic illustration of these three types of trading I just described. The picture on the left is point source trade. So this is the Happy River Basin, and the Happy River is impaired with high phosphorus loadings. It's causing a eutrophication problem in Lake Content, which is down there at the bottom of the picture. On one of the major tributaries of the river, as you can see on the left, there are three industrial facilities. They're clustered close together. If they, when they get their waste load allocations for phosphorus, they would be able quite easily, given their close proximity, to trade among themselves, perhaps under a single permit, to achieve the phosphorus reductions. The non-point source scenario is illustrated on the right. This is point non-point source trading with a single facility. So we have publicly owned treatment works there, Pleasantville, POTW, and then upstream is Herb's Farm, which also has low-cost ability to reduce its phosphorus loading. So in this PMDL scenario, which is actually built on a real case study in Idaho, the Pleasantville wastewater treatment plant would be able, could perhaps buy phosphorus reductions from the upstream farm. And then the next slide, slide 11, shows the third scenario, which is point non-point source trading on a watershed scale, where you could have, you know, potentially dozens of point source buyers and dozens or hundreds of non-point source sellers. You could also have point source sellers, but in a major question here is how big can this circle get? And that gets at the issue of the trading boundary, and we're going to talk in detail in a few slides about the concept of water quality equivalence and the ability to relate pollutant reductions in one part of the watershed to another part of the watershed. And it turns out that ability to relate pollutant reduction actions will determine the size of your trading boundary. It will also be affected by basic watershed features. That is, the size of your trading boundary will be affected by basic watershed features. There's a lake at the bottom, south part of this map, and there's a dam that creates the lake. There's a facility south of that dam, Laughing Larry's Trout Farm. In no scenario, trading scenario, would the trout farm be able to provide or secure phosphorus credits, because they are not hydrologically connected to the rest of the waterway and to the phosphorus loadings. So not only will the ability to relate pollutant movement through a watershed dictate the trading boundary, but basic features of the watershed that might stop or impede water and pollutant flow will also come into play. As we scale programs up to this size, point non-point source, there are a number of greater technical challenges, which we'll cover a little later. But the attraction is that you can also get efficiencies in running the program. You may have the ability to cluster non-point source riparian improvement projects in a way that gives you more benefit than you would from individual projects. And the potential cost savings, if you have a lot of point sources in a watershed, also can get very large, as we'll illustrate with some numbers later. But basically, I just wanted to this point to give you kind of the basic definition of trading and some of the basic ways in which trading plays out in the water context between point and non-point sources. And we're going to pause for questions in just a second. I did want to just mention there's a bullet on this slide that says several programs under development, and I just wanted to let you know that these are point non-point source trading programs on a watershed scale that are under development. In fact, there are several others we could add to that list as well. So it's an area that is being actively explored, and is sort of the next frontier, if you will, of trading. But right now we're going to pause and take your questions.
Thanks, Linda. I have a question here from Matthew in Pennsylvania, who says, given that this program is voluntary, what are the incentives to purchase pollutant credit?
Okay. The question is, if the program is voluntary, what are the incentives for purchasing pollutant credits? That gets back to what I was saying about the driver and the cap. Trading, just like, TMDL implementation without trading, will only happen if that bound or limit on pollutants has been set and is then implemented. So if a TMDL is developed and the state is in earnest about implementing it, then when the state is in earnest about implementing it, the NPDES permittees in that area or that state will need to get their permits updated to be consistent with the TMDL. At that point, if there is a trading program in place, and there are lower cost nutrient reductions available in their watershed, they would have a great incentive to trade. But you have to have, again, that cap or that limit set into place first in order to get trading going in the first place.
Thanks, Linda. I'm going to go ahead and open up the phone line. Is that questions? You can go ahead and ask them. Are there questions on the phone line for Linda?
Yeah, it seems like the watershed trading is specifically focused on nutrients. Is there any consideration for just toxic parameters?
Hi, the question is that there seems to be a lot of emphasis on nutrients and is trading used for other parameters, and we'll actually get a chance to get into this in more detail later, but for a number of reasons, nutrients are especially well-suited to trading, which has to do with the fact that they exert their effects over relatively long periods of time and large areas of space, which gives you more flexibility in where you control the nutrient loads. It's also quite often the case that you will have very different control costs within a watershed for nutrients. So that's why most of the attention in trading, I'd say 99.5% of the trading programs are centered around nitrogen or phosphorus.
Oh, right.
Although certainly not all of them, and there are trading programs for other parameters, and in fact we'll hear about one from Sonia, whose state is using trading to reduce temperature and thermal load in streams that are too warm for spawning salmonids. I'm aware also of a selenium trading program out in California, which was unusually actually among farmers because the state required them to reduce selenium loads that were coming from their irrigated water returns. So there are other parameters. I'm unaware of trading, other than the selenium example I just cited, I'm unaware of any trades for, I think you said, toxic pollutants. I'm unaware of those.
Other questions on the phone line for Linda?
Okay, thank you. We're going to go into a couple of examples that I hope will flesh out these concepts for you. And the first one is from Long Island Sound in Connecticut. And the setup for this problem is that there were extensive loadings of nitrogen coming into Long Island Sound from both point and non-point sources throughout the states of Connecticut and New York. And the nitrogen loadings were such that there was a hypoxia zone or an extremely low oxygen zone created in Long Island Sound each summer and presenting a danger to fish and very low water quality conditions in general. So the state of Connecticut is taking a proactive approach to this problem. They studied and modeled the situation pretty extensively, and then in about 2000, developed the total maximum daily load that calls for a 64% nitrogen reduction among 79 wastewater treatment plants that were located on tributaries throughout the state that drain into Long Island Sound. So that's the cap that we were talking about, 64% nitrogen reduction. and the time frame is that it needs to be achieved by 2014. So it was a very challenging goal and also a potentially very expensive goal. Initial state estimates were that it would cost $1 billion. The next slide shows you a map of the sound. The colored area is actually the water in the sound, with the green water being reasonably good shape and declining towards the lower left, where it's red and black there, and that's the hypoxia zone. Connecticut is north of this area, and New York is south of this area. Oh, I'm sorry. We're on slide 15. So what the state did, they had to figure out how they were going to implement this 64% nitrogen reduction goal. They looked at each wastewater treatment facility and figured out what percentage of the total wastewater flow in the state each facility contributed. So this pie chart on the left is total wastewater flow in the state, with just that 15% being an illustrative example. The pie chart on the right shows how they applied the cap of nitrogen reductions to all the facilities. So the outer ring of that pie chart is current loadings, or rather 2000 loadings, and the inner ring that has 2014 indicated on it is what the total loadings will be from all of those point sources in 2014. That's a 64% reduction. And this is just showing that in 2014, each plant is basically going to be contributing the same proportional amount in total nitrogen load as they are now. So they chose to, they're basically doing across the board, everybody's going to reduce proportional to the amount that they're contributing. The state had to figure out a way, we're moving now to slide 16, the state had to figure out a way, again, to reach this pretty challenging goal, and they didn't really like the looks of $1 billion. So they started thinking about more efficient ways to get this same nitrogen reduction. And what they came up with is a nitrogen exchange, which is, in essence, it is a trading program that allows all of the 79 wastewater treatment plants covered to either do the on-site controls to reduce nitrogen to the full amount that each facility is required to do, or to buy nitrogen reductions, nitrogen credits, from the exchange, or if they choose, they can invest the equipment to over-control, if you will, their own nitrogen, and then sell those reductions or credits to other wastewater treatment plants in the state. And again, the over-control will mean not only do they meet in a given year their allocation, they go below that. And whatever the increment below is the increment that's potentially available for sale. It may be discounted by ratios, but we'll get to that in a minute. So in this program, a credit is a pound of total nitrogen reduction every day for a year. That's a credit. That's what's exchanged in this program. The way it is being implemented is that there is a single NPDES permit for total nitrogen only that is issued to the 79 wastewater treatment plants. Almost all of them are publicly owned plants. I think one or two are privately run. That permit has an aggregate cap that declines every 2 years until it gets to the final cap amount in 2014. So every facility's the total amount and every facility's amount is being ratcheted down every 2 years. The books are reconciled, if you will, in July of every year. At that point, every facility, based on their monthly discharge monitoring reports, which all NPDES permittees must provide to the state, they submit to the state whether they need to secure credits, that is buy credits, or have credits to sell, or are right on the mark with their own reductions. So in this case, the state of Connecticut is actually the broker of the trades, which is the only model I know of where that's the case. So a concept that I want to explain on the next slide, which is slide 17, is very important in Connecticut's program and is very important in most large-scale trading programs, especially those that are getting reductions from over a large area to benefit a discrete target area, if you will. So in this case of Connecticut, they want to get the reductions throughout the state. That will have in-stream benefits, but the real goal is to reduce the reduce or eliminate the hypoxia zone in the sound. So what you have there is trading over a fairly large area to get reductions at a point certain downstream. And when you're dealing with trading, where the essence of trading, as we said, is you choose a different location and a different source to reduce the pollutants. And so as soon as you start moving the location of pollutant control within a watershed, you have to start asking yourself, is the impact of that pollutant reduction the same if it is made at point A or if it's made at point B? And the answer to that is often no, and that's why trading programs that cover a very large geographic area like this have to factor in what we call water quality equivalence. And what water quality equivalence does, again, is allows you to consider the impact of each pollutant control action, no matter where it's made, and then sort of normalize it at the target area of concern, in this case the hypoxia zone. And the way this does that is by applying ratios, or essentially discounting the pollutant reductions based on the fate and transport and whether those pollutants would have ended up in the hypoxia zone in the first place. And the next slide, I hope, will illustrate this concept. This is a map of the state of Connecticut. The sound is that area that's marked with a 12, slide 18. The sound is the area that has a 12 right in the middle of it. And then the land areas, Connecticut, is north and just south of that. The blue, the state is divided based on the pollutant fate and transport model, which they developed the TMDL on and are implementing this program based on. The state is divided into 12 what they call nitrogen planning zones, or we could call them equivalency zones. And I'll explain now what those zones mean. In the lower left corner where you see the blue box with a 1 in it, that means that in zone 10 there, a pound of nitrogen that is released from a plant in zone 10 is going to be immediately felt in its full volume or mass in the hypoxia zone. If you remember the map we looked at before, this was the location of the hypoxia zone. So every pound of nitrogen that is added right here is basically a full pound of insult, if you will, to the hypoxia zone. So this zone gets a value of 1. For every pound released from a pipe, a pound of nitrogen is felt, if you will, by the hypoxia zone. Just above that, across the sound, is zone 6. That has a 0.93 on it. So this is this zone is at a bit of a distance from the hypoxia area and is subject to pollutants. Nitrogen that's released here is more subject to attenuation as it travels down the tributaries and into the sound, and to currents in the sound. So based on the models, for every pound of nitrogen released in zone 6, just 0.93 pounds actually makes it to the hypoxia zone. And then similarly, all the way in eastern Connecticut, in zone 1, you'll see there's a box that says 0.18. And by this time, you've figured out what that means, which is that this point is so far away from the hypoxia zone that only 18% of all the nitrogen released here is ever going to make it to the hypoxia zone. It's a long distance to travel. It's going to attenuate. It's going to be taken up by plants. It's going to wash out to the ocean, some of it. And so the impact of the pollution and the impact of the pollutant reduction won't be fully felt in the sound. So that has a very, very high discount on it of almost 80%. Now, where these ratios come into play is if there are trades. If someone in Zone 10 wants to buy pollutant reduction credits from someone in Zone 1, they're actually going to have to buy at a 5-to-1 ratio, meaning for every pound of nitrogen they want to offset themselves, they're going to have to buy 5 pounds from the plant in Zone 1 because of the inefficiencies getting, you know, the nitrogen getting to it, the nitrogen from zone one getting to that point. So financially, that's probably not going to be a very attractive trade, but the main point is just that you would have to apply a ratio like that to make sure that the trades are equivalent and have an equivalent impact on, in this case, the hypoxia zone. Trades between zone 10 and zone 6 might be a little more attractive, in that, again, if your buyer is in zone 10, they would have to buy at a 10-9 ratio. So basically, for every 9 pounds of reduction that they needed, they'd have to buy 10. And so it is in this way that ratios are typically applied in any large-scale trading programs to take into account the spatial variability in where pollutant reductions are made and to ensure that the impact on, you know, the area that is of interest that they want to reduce pollutant loads to is in fact happening. And that does have implications for the financial attractiveness of trades, but that's another story which we don't have time to get into today. Okay, the next slide is slide 19. And this will close out our discussion of Long Island Sound. This graph, oh, by the way, I wanted to acknowledge Gary Johnson of Connecticut Department of Environmental Protection for all of these slides. This slide shows on the up-down axis pounds per day of nitrogen, where they were in 2000, where they want to be in 2014. Timeline is along the bottom. The red line is what the state anticipated it would get in nitrogen reductions through a standard program requiring all the point sources to make equal reductions. And the green line is the trajectory that they're on and that they expect to stay on with the trading program, because they have essentially provided incentives for plants that are going to upgrade anyway to do it early, and then to be able to sell any surplus reductions that they can, at least until the cap is ratcheted down again. So they are in about year 3 of their program. The latest data that is available, they're just about to publish their data for 2004, but it wasn't available today, but their data from 2003 is that in that year they reduced 2.7 million pounds of nitrogen. That's about 7,000 pounds a day. So the program is proceeding quite well. And I think at this point we pause again for questions. Any questions on the Connecticut Long Island Sound program?
Lynn, I've got a question here from Gail in Oregon, who asks, what has been the experience dealing with hot spots or third-party effects that will not be addressed or may be worsened by a trading scheme?
That's a very important question. I do have a couple slides particularly on hotspots a little later, but we can cover the high points now. Hotspots are for those that may not be familiar with the term, refers to locally high pollutant concentrations that may occur because one party is buying a lot of credit. So in other words, they're increasing their discharge. They're buying credits elsewhere in the watershed to offset that, but what does that mean for the water segment they're on? Is that water segment going to be okay, or is it going to have very high local concentrations? So that hotspots are an issue every trading program has to deal with in the design phase and in implementation. There are a number of ways of doing that. I do have a couple slides on this later, so it might be best to walk through those sequentially, but essentially, you can anticipate a number of the conditions that are likely that are more likely to create hotspots. For example, if you have a very large buyer of credits, you will want to look and make sure that trade isn't going to cause locally high pollutant concentrations. If you have a large trade or large again, purchase of credits, because the one purchasing the credit is the one that's not reducing its own loading as much. If you have a large trade right above a highly impaired segment of a stream, or in particular, just upstream from a reservoir. Now, those are the kind of conditions that trading programs have to think about and have to anticipate, and There are a number of approaches to avoiding hotspots, which are being taken right now and which I'll go into in more detail. But it's a very important question. It has to be anticipated in program design, and there are several ways to do that and also to avoid creating hotspots, and we'll cover those in a subsequent slide.
I'm going to go ahead and open up the phone lines if there are questions for Linda. Are there any questions out there on the phone lines?
Hi, yes, Linda. This is Matt Mitchell in Region 9.
Hi.
I had a question about Connecticut. It looks to me like some of those zones are in New York State in the South. I was wondering, I mean, you said Connecticut runs the program. Is there involvement in some of these New York facilities?
As far as I know, to date, Connecticut has been aggressively implementing this program. My understanding is that New York is intending to implement the TMDL as well, but I don't believe they're nearly as far along on that path. So far, the trades have just been among Connecticut facilities.
Because it looks like, I mean, I'm from Long Island, so it looks like Zone 10 and 11 are New York, but...
Yeah, that they are.
Okay.
They are. I was actually just sorry if that was confusing. I was using that as an example of how to use ratios.
Oh, okay.
I didn't mean to imply that
they were
trades in New York were taking place.
Okay. Thanks.
Linda, you had mentioned some of the incentives the state has provided for the early upgrades at the plants. What were those incentives? Some of those incentives?
The incentive is that if they upgrade, they can basically get revenue by selling the extra pollutant reductions that they generate.
Great, thanks, Linda. I'm going to allow you to go ahead and move on in the presentation and continue. You want to ask folks to go ahead and hold off on their questions. Thanks.
Okay, our next example is north of the border in Ontario, and it's a very different situation than the New York program. This is a small watershed in Ontario called the South Nation River. Ontario is divided into conservation districts, not unlike the way we are in the States. And one conservation district there has implemented a watershed-scale point non-point source trading program. So we don't quite have one of those implemented in the U.S. yet, which is why I wanted to use this one as an example of how it could work, which is not to say I think this is a perfect program, but I think it's a very good example of how to engage the agricultural community and also a model of how a conservation district can essentially serve as a broker for trades. So the watershed that we're in is the South Nation River. As I said, it's impaired by phosphorus and highly dominated by non-point sources. It's about 90% of the phosphorus comes from non-point source loads, primarily dairy farms. And as here, the point sources in Canada are at permits and are required to meet them. And meet limits, and the non-point sources, the approach is more to give funding and encourage them to put in best management practices. So in terms of the basic setup, it's the same as here. Okay, slide 22 just gives a little background information on the water quality problem. As you can see, it is not a pretty picture. The river is highly degraded with phosphorus and five times higher than their water quality objectives, as they call them, analog to our water quality standards. They did have 18 small to medium-sized wastewater treatment plants in the watershed, and a number of them wanting to expand and at least one or two new facilities wanting to come in. And, of course, as here, high treatment costs for tertiary level phosphorus or, you know, advanced level of phosphorus control. So they started looking at a cap-and-trade kind of an arrangement in about 1999 or 2000. And slide 23 shows that they capped phosphorus lows at the 1998 levels based on ambient monitoring data that they had and record keeping from the point sources, and basically said we're not going to allow any additional loading of phosphorus to the river, and therefore new or expanded point source discharges must have a no net increase of phosphorus by either treating to zero or by buying credits to offset. And they said at the outset that the ratio, the offset ratio is going to be 4 to 1. So again, that means for every 1 pound of total phosphorus that a point source was going to be adding to the river, they were going to have to pay to take out 4 pounds of phosphorus. And the South Nation Conservation Authority is serving as the broker for all of these phosphorus trades, and in a couple subsequent slides I'll run through that process with you so you get a sense of what it is. But basically, on slide 24, what they did was to develop a set of eligible best management practices. Again, we're dealing largely with dairy farms, so it was mostly about manure management, but also milk house wash water, and livestock access to the streams, which in some cases was still occurring. What they did was identified a set, a discrete set of best management practices that would be eligible for program funding that could create credits. And they developed a fairly detailed set of calculations, which are available if folks are interested, on for each of these, on just how much phosphorus each of these would keep out of the water, even down to per animal for some of them. So it was on that basis that they identified how phosphorus credits would be generated. Again, they were going to apply a 4 to 1 ratio. So if a manure lagoon, if there'd been an open manure pile that was being put into a lagoon, and say that trapped 100 kilograms per year of total phosphorus, only 25 of those would be available for point source use, as it were. And they actually made one question that comes up in trading programs is, and I think Sonia will touch on this in her presentation, is when are credits, when do they become available in the, especially in non-point source trading programs? Is it when the farmer agrees to do the project, or is it when the project's installed, or is it when the BMP is fully functioning? So when and how you allocate credits is a question. They decided to allocate credits as soon as the project was installed, and given that most of these projects are basic storage projects, that probably is a reasonable decision, because as soon as you start storing the stuff, it's not running off. Slide 25 will just give you an overview of how the trading process works in the South Nation program. Basically, the South Nation Conservation negotiates TPM as total phosphorus management agreement with a discharger. So if a discharger is going to increase their load, they don't get the permit until they go to South Nation and say, okay, I'm going to grow, my community's growing by 300 people in the next year, I need to discharge, whatever, 100 kilograms more per year of phosphorus. They then have to pay South Nation Conservation the money per kilogram of phosphorus, again, times 4, and that money funds the total phosphorus management program. A Clean Water Committee reviews eligible agricultural projects in the watershed and then allocates the money to projects. And they have they've really engaged the farming community and the agricultural professionals of the community in this process, which I think is working very well for them. They have field reps that, first of all, help to come up with the BMPs, that do site inspections, that get the certification that the projects are finished, and then report that information to the Clean Water Committee. So the committee reviews projects, approves them, and then once it is verified that the project is complete, invoices for the construction are provided, photos of the completed project are provided, and 10% of them are actually inspected to ensure that they're working properly. At that point, the credits become available. This continues on slide 26. Total phosphorus reductions available are calculated, and they are then sort of in a bank, a credit bank. which at that point is available for point source, the point source dischargers to draw on. And then they provide a report and circulate information to stakeholders, which is an important aspect of what they do as well. Although it is interesting that the point source buyers do not know who they are buying credits from. This is sort of how the bank functions. The farmers are anonymous to them. They just know that they're getting the secured credits. The South Nation Conservation Authority knows who's doing the projects, but the actual buyers don't. The next slide just shows that monitoring is an important part of this program, and any water quality management program, including trading programs. They have a good historical base of ambient monitoring data, and they continue that at 13 stations throughout the watershed. An important point, however, is that this monitoring is for ambient water quality trends, and it, in most cases, is not possible to monitor the actual water quality performance at the site of best management practices. You can get good estimates. You can ensure that the practices are working. But in most cases, you can't verify that a BMP is working through ambient data. You just are using that data for to see if the program as a whole is working, not a specific practice. So that's the end of the second example. And I think, we're going to skip over. We were going to have a question session, but I'm running a little behind. So, okay. We're going to move on to avoiding hotspots, as promised, and then a quick overview of where we stand with trading, and then I'll hand it over to Sonia. But as we've talked about before, I covered some of these before when that important question was raised about hotspots. Every program has to deal with this. It's an important design issue, and it is also it can be, in general, circumstances that might create hotspots can be anticipated. The first two I already talked. In fact, I think I touched on most of these, except maybe the last one, which is that when you're dealing with a very large trading area, and if you cross numerous equivalency zones, such as those we talked about in Connecticut, you have to do a double check to make sure that you're not creating an area where tons and tons of credits are being purchased, and not a lot of actual reductions are being made. So those are the those are the types of situations that should be examined to see if they could create hotspots. They won't always, but they have to be looked at closely. And then trading program design approaches that avoid hotspots can be implemented, which is on the next slide, okay, which for you is 29. And all of these are actually in use in trading programs around the country now. First one is for group permits. That the permit is only issued for the single parameter that's being traded, and individual permit limits remain in place for all other parameters. So, for example, in Connecticut, every facility has limits driven by local water quality concerns for ammonia nitrogen, and they're just trading the total nitrogen. You can limit the number of credits used within an area if that seems appropriate. You can also limit the direction of trades. If trades are occurring, if credits are being generated upstream, you basically avoid the hotspot question altogether because you're always getting the reductions before you're adding in, you're getting to the discharger that isn't reducing as much. That, again, you don't have to do that to avoid hotspots, but it is an option. And another approach is to apply minimum reductions for each facility or just to in some way limit the amount of their allocation that they can achieve through trading. So all of those are options. They're, I think all of them are being used in one program or another. And, again, it's an important area to consider. We're going to skip on because I'm being told I'm a little behind, so I'm going to try to hurry this up a little bit. We're on slide 31, which is just a broad overview of sort of where trading is happening now in one form or another. If a state is white, it means they have a state or regional trading policy in place. The blue diamonds refer to one-time offset agreements. That would be a single NPDEF facility. utility that has secured from a single landowner some credits. And then the red diamonds are ongoing trading programs. Those could be single facility programs, or as in Connecticut, they could be very large-scale programs. And then the green, other projects and recent proposals, some of those developing point-non-point first watershed scale projects I mentioned are included in these green triangles. And in other places, it just means the state's exploring trading or might do a trading framework or policy. And the source for this information, for anyone who leaves this presentation wanting a lot more information about where trading is going on now, is here at the bottom right of the slide, and it's a very comprehensive source from about a year ago of where trading projects are going on. And I think in the interest of time, we can skip the next slide, and I'm just going to go ahead and introduce Sonia, and to say thank you very much to her in advance for doing this presentation. As I have mentioned before, most trades are to control nutrients, but they aren't all to control nutrients. And from Sonia, we're going to hear about a water quality problem that's endemic, I think, in a lot of parts of the West, which is that the water is too warm for sensitive fish species, and an innovative project that they're doing in Oregon to address that in the Tualatin River Basin. So thank you, Sonia, and take it away.
Okay, here I am. Okay, I'm glad to be able to talk about water quality trading in Oregon. I'm actually kind of proud of what we've accomplished because it's different than trading projects that have happened elsewhere. And so let's just get right in. I wanted to talk first actually about some perceptions of trading because these can get in the way in different ways. And my own perceptions have changed quite a bit since I started. When I started getting involved in trading a few years ago, I kept hearing proponents say that trading is a way to bring free market efficiencies to reduce compliance costs. And I don't know, that made it sound like something a free market economist under Ronald Reagan would come up with, and I didn't think that was going to pave the way with environmental groups, and I don't think it does. So we need to be sort of careful how we talk about it and who we talk about it to that way. Because opponents, which includes a lot of environmental groups, view it as a way for polluters to get off the hook. So we need to just take that on and deal with it. I've developed an alternate view, which is that trading can be a better way to protect the resource, and I hope I managed to convince you of that by the end of the presentation. First, I want to talk about, just give you a quick idea of where we did this. This is the next slide, slide 35, shows the Tualatin Basin in Oregon. The Tualatin Basin is located in the upper left-hand corner of Oregon. It's got a piece of Portland in it, but actually a lot of it's fairly rural. Green shows trees. Yellow shows ag lands. Red shows more urbanized areas. The Tualatin River, which we'll be talking about, is the wiggly black line sort of in the lower half of the Tualatin Basin. And streams that currently support salmonid spawning are pink, and you'll see those mostly in the green areas. And then other streams support migration. Let's move to the next slide, slide 36. This was taken in 1999. It's a sort of, think of it as a temperature picture of the Tualatin River. And your eye's sort of naturally drawn to this big drop on at River Mile 65 or so. We've got River Mile on the horizontal axis, stream temperature on the vertical axis. That is where a bunch of water gets discharged from a reservoir, and early in the season it's cold. The rest of the graph shows a lot of warming. The blue line is actual stream temperature, taken, as I say, with a special kind of photograph. And then the red is what the computer simulated in the TMDL model. Now, the source that we were most concerned about was the Rock Creek Treatment Plant, owned by Clean Water Services. And if you look about in the middle, you'll see Rock Creek and Rock Creek WWTP, Wastewater Treatment Plant. And you'll see that a little warming happens right there. And you'll also notice that it's very small compared to the amount of warming that takes place in the rest of the river. So what we have here is a situation where we have regulatory control over a small piece of the problem. And trading, where we can ask ourselves, what's a good way to take the regulatory control that we have to get after what's arguably the real problem? In the Tualatin River, it's not treatment plants discharging hot water to the river, though there is a little bit of warming resulting from that. It's mostly things like lack of riparian shade, lack of streamside shade, altered channel shape, and we'll be talking about that more as I go on. But right now, let's go to slide 37. So I want to give you a quick overview of the trade that we developed with Clean Water Services. Actually, there's two parts to it, but I'm mostly going to be focusing on the temperature trade. The temperature trade involves a combination of letting them do streamside planting, of riparian shading, in other words, and flow augmentation to offset their temperature impact. If you remember that, the water from the reservoir in the last slide cools down the river a lot. They've actually purchased some water rights to that reservoir to encourage that to happen when it's most needed. We also authorize another type of trade with Clean Water Services, and that is we're allowing them to trade BOD and ammonia in between their treatment plants. They actually have more than one treatment plant that discharges to the Tualatin, but I didn't bother pointing out the other one, which is much further downstream because you can't really see the temperature impact anyway. I'm not really going to talk about the BOD and ammonia trade, partly because it's kind of complicated and partly because it hasn't actually happened. They're able to do this kind of trading, but the circumstances under which they can do it are pretty limited and haven't actually had a trade transpire yet. So just going to leave that for another presentation another day. Let's go to slide 38. And let's talk about some advantages to letting Clean Water Services offset their temperature impact via riparian shading and flow augmentation. Well, the alternative for them, unfortunately, was putting in a huge expensive refrigerator. You couldn't do it just with a swamp cooler, if anybody's familiar with that is what that is, because they wouldn't get their effluent sufficiently cool to meet their waste load allocation. They actually had to look at mechanical refrigeration. That was going to be extremely expensive. They were looking at $50 to $100 million to cool sewage treatment plant effluent, and that felt really dumb to just about everybody. And it also would have taken a lot of electricity, which in the Pacific Northwest, a lot of that's generated by hydroelectric plants, which are bad for salmon, and the point of the temperature standard was to protect salmon. So this just didn't really feel like a solution, and that's why we were so interested in considering trading. Anyway, by allowing them to do riparian shading with native plants and also practice flow augmentation, we figured we'd get a much greater environmental benefit. And, of course, it'd also be cheaper for them. Let's go to slide 39. There's also some side benefits to letting them do this that I didn't really think too hard about, but we're starting to get. We're finding out what it takes to get riparian areas planted on agricultural land. And I will share some of those lessons with you later. Remind me if I don't. And as time goes on, we're also going to learn a lot about what it takes to keep it planted. So let's move on to slide 40. Now let's talk about how much they're going to have to do. For flow augmentation, they are able to purchase on a consistent basis about 30 cubic feet per second throughout the summer. There's a lot of other people who want the water, so they can't buy everything they want. But they can consistently get about that. And that's enough to offset about half their excess heat load. So we figure they have to do about 35 miles of stream restoration to offset the rest. And you might be thinking, well, how does that work? I'll be talking about that a bunch. also, I probably should change the number at some point, 35 miles. We were assuming a stream about 10 feet across, and we were assuming something like 80 to 90% shade on that stream. Actually, they're getting much smaller streams planted, so that means they're going to have to do more. So this number is probably going to go higher. Let's talk a little bit about how we quantify the impact of riparian restoration. We do it by quantifying the amount of solar radiation that's blocked by the shade-producing vegetation. If it's blocked by the shade, it can't warm up the stream. And I should probably point out that shade doesn't so much cool a stream as it prevents it from warming up. So it's best when you can do it in the upper watershed areas where the stream is first starting to get, you know, degraded riparian areas. Let's move on to slide 42. I want to do a little bit of Pacific Northwest landscape education. I want to talk about good versus bad riparian areas, so you'll see it'll help you appreciate some of the benefits of this trade. Slide 42 shows what I'd call a nice, healthy riparian area in a forested stream in the Tualatin Basin. Now, lots of different streams can be healthy and look lots of different ways, but in the Tualatin upper watersheds, this is good. We've got mature trees and diverse vegetation and not really any down cutting. Let's compare and contrast that to the next slide, 43. This is actually typical of about 60% of the stream miles in the Tualatin Basin. We've got a lot of down cutting here and very little native riparian vegetation. We've got a few trees off to the left, but not too many. The banks are actually dominated by a non-native species called Himalayan blackberry. Actually, it's a hybrid that was developed. Anyway, it doesn't matter, but it makes you wonder about genetic engineering that this hybrid plant has been able to colonize so many streams in the Pacific Northwest. The Himalayan blackberry isn't doing the stream any good. It doesn't hold the soil in place. It doesn't provide shade. It doesn't provide much in the way of habitat for wildlife. There's a few birds who like it, especially when the berries come out, but so that's like a store that's open 1 month a year. The rest of the time it doesn't do anything. And because it doesn't hold the soil in place, it's allowing the stream to downcut a lot, and that's a serious problem. This stream would actually be very difficult to restore at this point because the banks are so steep that it would be tough to get vegetation established, and it would be tough to keep the roots wet enough during the dry season. We don't really have rain here from about middle of June to end of October. So if the stream drops too far, it makes it really hard for vegetation to stay established. And this process of the stream downcutting is going to continue until the stream hits the same elevation as the river it's joining onto. And then at that point, it's going to want to get wider. And it's going to take a lot of land with it. And this is a dynamic that's playing out in a lot of places. And that's why I want to take a minute to explain it. Let's talk about how they get so bad, how streams can get this way. Well, really, it's because streams are messy and unpredictable, and people try to control them. We want to live alongside them. We want to plant food alongside them. So we do things like we take out the vegetation, we straighten the channels, we install dikes and levees, and we also don't like to walk in the mud and drive in the mud, so we create impervious areas. We put down lots of asphalt, and that causes problems for streams as well, especially in urbanized areas. Tualatin doesn't have a lot of urbanized areas, but a lot of parts of the country do. And as urbanized areas get more intensively developed and there's more impervious area, more parking lots, more buildings, more streets, peak flows to streams increase, and that accelerates the downcutting process. So let's move on to slide 45. And I guess I just really already talked about this, so we can go on to slide 46. We wanted to talk about how much shade is enough. Here's a basic equation. The amount of stream that Clean Water Services needs to restore is going to be equal to their excess heat load, which is defined in the TMDL documents, divided by the reduced solar load and the stream width. And then let's move on to slide 47. Here is a chart that shows daily solar loading rates in Oregon. It shows all the basins in Oregon. Different colors correspond to different loading rates. This data comes from Department of Energy. I just want to give you an idea of how we actually calculate things. The following slide, 48, is a graph from the TMDL report that shows effective shade on Gales Creek. Gales Creek is a tributary of the Tualatin. It's considered a prime candidate for restoration because it does actually have salmonid spawning and rearing. It's got good habitat. So it also has a lot of degraded areas, and I'll try and show how that, what that's like. So the red line shows the moving average of current shade along Gales Creek, and you'll see it's all over the map. It's as low as 10%. It's as high as 80, 90%. The blue dots and the blue line at the top show what we estimate is possible at different reaches of the creek based on site potential vegetation, what we know that particular ecosystem is capable of supporting if you leave it alone long enough, you know, how tall the trees get, what density they get to. We got numbers like that from Oregon Department of Forestry. Anyway, we figure a lot of the stream right now is, you know, on the order of 40%, plus or minus 30%, and it could be much closer to 90%. Let's move on to slide 49. You might be thinking, we probably ran into some problems when we started talking about all this with everybody, and we did. People pointed out that trees would take a long time to grow compared to putting in a refrigerator, and then also we're talking about giving Clean Water Services credit for something farmers should already be doing. I totally expected both of these criticisms, and it was a big reason I didn't get underway with trying to do this particular type of trade for, gosh, about a year after EPA gave us the grant to pursue trading. I just thought, well, how am I going to answer those questions? And surprisingly enough, it was actually somebody from an environmental group who made me think that maybe I should pursue it anyway. He said, if you don't, you're missing an opportunity. He didn't try to tell me how he thought I could address these criticisms, but he said, if you don't, you're missing an opportunity. And it suddenly dawned on me that maybe not everybody would hate it if we tried to pursue this, so I would try because I agreed with them. Let's talk about how we dealt with the question of trees take a long time to grow. Go on to slide 50, please. And you see a graph here. Let's say for the sake of argument that Clean Water Services decided to solve their problem with a refrigerator, and they decided the refrigerator probably lasts about 20 years. Well, at year one, they'd turn on the refrigerator, they'd get some cooling. It would be represented by that horizontal line. This is, of course, a bit idealized, but anyway, it would be represented by that horizontal line, and it would be good for 20 years. Whereas if you plant trees, year one, you don't get any shade, and then eventually you get a bunch. What we came up with, and I should point out, I was working with a sort of ad hoc advisory group as I designed this trade. It represented environmental groups, Clean Water Services, of course, Oregon Department of Ag, some other groups. Anyway, what they said would kind of feel okay to them is if they knew that at the end of 20 years, the amount of, quote, cooling achieved by shade was twice what you would have gotten with refrigeration, because then the area under these two lines is equal. Now, I know this is all very idealized, but this is what we came up with, and the trade still stands. It hasn't been sued. It's happening. So let's move on to slide 51. Anyway, that means the equation that I showed you a little while back needs to be modified. It needs to have a 2 in front of it. And so there it is. Slide 51 shows 2 times excess heat load over reduced daily solar load times river width. Let's move on to slide 52. So let's talk about how Clean Water Services is going about getting riparian areas planted. They've actually developed 2 different incentive programs, and actually now I think they have 3, and they're thinking about a 4th. Let's just talk about the first couple. One is called Enhanced CREP. It basically piggybacks on a federal program known as CREP, stands for Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program or something like that, and it's a program under which farmers can be reimbursed for part of the cost of planting riparian areas. Washington County, where this trade was taking place, had no participants in CREP. It's not that there isn't enough money coming from the feds for this program. Nobody wanted to participate. So Clean Water Services decided to try and find out why and up the incentive rate or, you know, amount of money that farmers would get and, you know, work with farmers to find out what that amount of money had to be. So they put together their own advisory council where they had people from the Farm Bureau and regular farmers and I don't remember all who, but anyway, basically they figured out that if they were going to get any interest from farmers, they needed to pay them about twice what CREP was going to provide. So that's one program they came up with, and then they came up with another program because they realized that a lot of farmers, it didn't really matter how much money was available through CREP or Enhanced CREP. They just didn't want to work with a lot of bureaucrats and do a lot of paperwork, and they just didn't want to do that. So Clean Water Services came up with a very simple program for them where all they do is they provide the farmer with free plants and the farmer puts them in. Of course, have a little less control over how everything happens in that program, but anyway, it is a way to get some stuff planted, and Clean Water Services is willing to take some chances with it. So, yeah, okay. But for people in Enhanced CREP, they have a contract with NRCS to enroll farmers and get riparian areas planted. So NRCS is sort of like a sub to Clean Water Services on this project, and they love me over there. Anyway, it keeps their people busy. I shouldn't say they love me. I don't know. They haven't said that, but let's see. So they have this contract with NRCS to enroll farmers and get riparian areas planted. There's about 1,900 farmers in the basin, so there's plenty of folks they can work with. And we're getting good involvement. When I say good involvement, it looks like Clean Water Services is going to get the number of farmers that they need to sign up to offset their heat load. It doesn't mean a huge number of farmers are actually signing up. If you remember from one of the slides at the very beginning, Clean Water Services is a small part of the temperature problems in the Tualatin, and so it only takes a small number of farmers to help them meet their goal. Still, we're finding out some interesting things about it, and so we'll keep going. Slide 53. I wanted to talk for just a minute about another way to get riparian areas planted that the City of Portland is using. They also have to think about getting riparian areas planted as part of complying with the Endangered Species Act. And I'm mentioning what they're doing because I think it's a kind of cool example of a non-binding, non-legal type agreement that's still accomplishing a lot. What they do is they just have this one-page sort of form that they give to, this is urban landowners now, this is people who own houses and happen to have a stream in their backyard. And the piece of paper says, hey, you give us access to your backyard, we'll install native plantings, and in exchange, you don't cut them down. So it's really, really simple, and it's working out pretty well. I talked to the guy who designed this program, and he said after 7 years of getting stuff planted, things are pretty much intact. So they got rid of the nasty Himalayan blackberry and English ivy and other invasives that we have out here that don't really do our streams any good, and they replaced it with native vegetation that provides much better shade and habitat, and it's sticking. It's good. And for minimum administrative costs, I feel like pointing out. Let's move on to slide 54. Let's talk about how we are going about establishing compliance for Clean Water Services. Well, this is tricky because stream temperature is very variable. You might remember that very first graph that just showed a one-page snapshot, but even on that one snapshot, you could see that there was a lot of variation with Rift River Mile. And let's be blunt about this. We can't be absolutely sure that we're going to measure the impact of restoration projects at the outfall. There's just so many things going on here, and even though the restoration projects are going to be all upstream of of Clean Water Services outfalls, some of them are going to be fairly small, and it's not like you're going to be able to hold a temperature in the water at the Clean Water Services outfall and see that temperature come down before your very eyes. No, it's not going to be like that. And there's other difficulties. It's possible that some of the restoration projects will get eaten up by bugs or killed by droughts. And now there's uncertainty in this. And there's global warming. And that is going to, frankly, I think, erase or mask the temperature benefit of these projects. And some people don't even like me to bring that up because they think it's too depressing. I feel like bringing it up anyway for a couple of reasons. One is I think it's an important problem to acknowledge. Another is that planting trees is a good way to deal with global warming, and that's what this trade is about. And so even if we don't get to see dramatic cooling taking place in the Tualatin River, we get to know we're doing something that will help with global warming, and that makes it worthwhile. The next slide is number 55, and it's just some evidence that I stumbled across of evidence in global warming in Oregon. And because I want to make sure there's some time for questions, I'm just going to scoot past it to slide 56 and talk more about how we're going to establish compliance. For the first 5 years following permit issuance, we're going to establish compliance with respect to adherence to the planting plans that they've developed. And by the way, there's lots of detail in all of this if you're interested. On the DEQ website, you can look up their permit and you can look up their temperature management plan where they talk about all this stuff. After 5 years, we expect to base compliance on plant survival rates and shade density measurements. In other words, we're not going to do it based on in-stream temperature. Some people question that. Hope I've sort of explained why we're not going to completely base it on temperature. That doesn't mean we're not going to do temperature monitoring. We're not going to base compliance on that. Let's go on to slide 57. So here's the status of the Clean Water Services trade. They've met their goals for the first year. They got 5 miles of stream planted, and there's a little bit more I'd like to share with you on that. I was just talking to Bruce Corden yesterday. He is the person at Clean Water Services who's designed the incentive programs, the most responsible for designing them, and is, of course, monitoring things, and he said it would be okay to give his phone number, so I'm going to give it right now. His name is Bruce Cordon, C-O-R-D-O-N, and his number is 503-681-3627. As I mentioned previously, they are getting a good rate of sign-up. They're getting more than enough, but we are finding some interesting things with the people that have signed up. One is that the streams that people have are smaller than we expected, so that means they're going to have to do, Clean Water Services is going to have to do more planting than they anticipated. We were expecting, you know, lots of 10-foot streams, and instead we're getting 3-foot streams and 5-foot streams, and those are good, and I'm glad we're going to be able to do this, but it's a little different than what we expected. Another thing we're finding that's kind of surprising is how many times the stream is actually the border of the property, so the property owner is talking about planting one side of the stream. We really weren't expecting that, and that's obviously far from ideal. So now Clean Water Services is starting to think about ways to pull in the other landowner, you know, extra incentives, bounties, whatever you want to call it, get both sides of that stream planted, for crying out loud. So that's an interesting little thing we've been finding. Another thing that we've been finding is the keep your hands off my land ethic is alive and well, in that Clean Water Services has offered a very generous easement price. We want to see stuff stay planted, and the best way to do that is for Clean Water Services to buy easements on all the land that gets planted. The farmers don't want it. They offered permanent easements, 20-year easements, 30-year easements, and the price that Clean Water Services will pay for the easement is more than the market value of the land, and still nobody's signing up. They're saying they're going to keep it planted, but they're not willing to lock up their land in an easement. So this, you know, this creates some real uncertainty for Clean Water Services. They're going to have to track things closely, and they might have to overplant, and, you know, they're going to have to compensate for stuff that doesn't stay planted. We can talk about it more, but anyway, so that's something we didn't expect. One last thing I feel like mentioning about the projects that have been started so far, and we're just talking about really a few dozen. People seem to either go for a minimum buffer width or a maximum buffer width. The minimum buffer width is 35 feet, and I think what's going on there is they want to keep as much of their land in farmland as possible, or they go for the maximum that's allowable under CREP, and they go for 180 feet. So in some cases, Clean Water Services is getting to pay for 180 feet of buffer on like a 5-foot stream. And, well, that's interesting. Bruce Cordon says it's great for wildlife, and he sounded real excited, and I'm glad he did, but anyway, I'm a little surprised that they're going to go that way. So let's move on to slide 58. I hope that I've given you some reasons why we wanted to do this and some of the benefits, how we're going to quantify it, and how to achieve compliance. And I wanted to, you know, I think actually I should do what Linda did and save questions until the end, unless I hear something right now. Okay, I'm going to just keep moving on. So we're going to go on to slide 59. Let's talk about what's next for trading. Well, it's kind of rewarding, actually, since things are happening. For a while, I thought maybe this was just going to be a one-hit wonder, and I kind of had the website with the questions and answers sort of written that way. But something's forming now called the Willamette Partnership. I should say it has formed. They got a grant from the EPA, and it's an effort to expand trading to the entire Willamette Basin. Tualatin Basin is a subset. You can learn more about that by visiting their website. It's just willamettepartnership.org, and you can also find links from our website. I want to talk briefly about something called hyperreic flow, because we're thinking this is another option for trading. It refers to flow through the gravels below and at the margins of a river, the hyperreic zone. And we know that that happens, and we know that cooling takes place when that happens. We don't really know how much, so we're working to quantify that. I'm working with Oregon State University on a research project to try and quantify that. But at any rate, it matters, because there used to be a lot more hyperreic flow than there is now. And slide 61 shows you a picture of the Willamette River back in 1850 compared to 1995. It's been enormously simplified. Another way to put it would be, back in 1850, it was really easy to get lost trying to go down the Willamette River, but we've made it much simpler. But in the olden days, there used to be a lot more hyperreef flow because the channel was constantly moving and shifting over newly forming and changing gravel bars, and now it's not. Let's move on to slide 62. I've got a couple different slides on this, and I think I'm going to get through them quickly. Anyway, there's different ways you can achieve hyperreic flow through things like floodplain restoration and recreating old side channels. Slide 63, we need to make sure we're not messing up groundwater and make sure that cooling's adequate. Slide 64 talks about a couple other kinds of trades that I've tried to get something going with and haven't been successful. I'm just going to put them out really quickly. Trading in the context of UAAs. UAA stands for use attainability analysis. When a river can't meet water quality standards, one alternative is to come up with a use attainability analysis that demonstrates why the standard doesn't apply here. It can't be met. So you need a different standard or something like that. A UAA is a good way to keep a lot of lawyers and consultants busy, but it doesn't do anything for the environment. I like to think that when you have an impact that you can't really do much about, like the Grand Coulee Dam, you could still do trading to mitigate the impact of that dam. But I haven't made a lot of headway with that. And another idea I had for trading was in the Columbia Slough in Portland, where they have a lot of contaminated soils and a lot of cleanup sites. The background level of contamination is rather high. It's actually higher than the standards for a lot of contaminants. I thought maybe you could have folks who have property in those areas, instead of having them clean up to better than background, which doesn't really make a lot of sense and it's hard to pull off regulatorily speaking, instead you have them contribute to removing contaminated sediments in the Columbia Slough. Haven't really gotten anywhere with that one yet either, but there's still hope. The slide 65 shows a graph of the impact of dams on temperature, but let's just move on. Slide 66, I want to talk about when trading is not likely to work. Talk a lot about what we need to have it happen. I want to talk about a couple things that can get in the way, because I've certainly run into them. It is a big problem when regulators, permitted sources, and environmental groups don't trust each other, and usually they don't, so it's sort of something you have to work with right away. Also, trading's not likely to happen if parties don't feel a sense of urgency. Clean Water Services did, and we did. DEQ did, that is, and that's the reason the trade came off. If there isn't any big driver pushing it, if there's no moment of truth, you know, it's maybe not ever going to happen. Let's go to slide 67. Let's see, it's important to work with stakeholders to design trades. We can't just sit in our ivory tower and do it because the Clean Water Services is silent on trading, and when you don't have rules, you better have trust. You got to work to build that. Here's what we heard from the stakeholders we worked with in the Clean Water Services trade. They said, pursue trades involving shade. That was huge. I didn't expect that. They said, limit the duration of the credit to 20 years. That simplified our life a lot to be able to talk about it that way because, as we found, it's very, very difficult to get farmers to lock up their land in perpetuity. It's an open question what happens at 20 years, by the way. And they said, compensate for the time it takes trees to grow. Let's talk quick about some lessons learned. If stakeholders appreciate that trading's a better way to protect the resource, they can accept some stuff that I personally wasn't sure anybody'd accept. One is a longer time frame for implementation. Trees take a lot longer to grow than it takes to build a refrigerator. They were willing to accept environmental benefit in a location other than the outfall. They appreciated that restoration on a salmonid-producing stream, one that could support salmonid spawning and rearing. That's salmonid is another word for salmon. Those are the fish that we're always trying to protect the most out here because they're on the endangered species list. They could see that that was of more value than putting a refrigerator at Clean Water Services outfall. And they're willing to accept some uncertainty. So anyway, I view trading as a tool that you can use in which you can ask, what is the best way to protect the resource? Is it just focusing on the point source impact, or is there something else we can do in the watershed that would help more? And if so, what is it, and can we use the regulatory clout that we have with the point source to bring that about? And I'd like to point out that our perceptions of trading can limit the potential for trading. So as I've mentioned, now I'm on slide 71. DEQ has a web page on trading, and we've just updated it. Mentions the limit partnership now, and that's all I had. So I'll turn it over to the moderator, who will open it up for questions.
Questions for either Linda or Sonia, so please feel free to go ahead and ask your questions.
Learn anything?
Yeah, hi. This is Kathleen Kuchenreuter in OWL at EPA headquarters. I actually have a question for each one of you. I'm not sure how you want to handle that. Should I start off with Sonia?
Okay.
Okay. The question had to do with your discussion about the kind of alternative analysis that came out with regard to the refrigeration versus the tree planting, and I found your graph very interesting there. To play devil's advocate, or maybe to take the perspective of the enviros for a second here, I have two questions. First of all, and I think you touched on this at the very end as a stakeholder question, but what do you do prior to the first a point where the tree planting and the refrigeration meet as far as their effectiveness? What kind of compensation have you been asked or required to provide in that interim period where you could be achieving a level of cooling prior to the 10 years? And then that spike after the 10 years, where is the point where you're actually achieving the temperature that you indeed need for the focal species, and is it really important to go above the line of the refrigeration after that 10 years? These are just some questions that I have because the basic fundamental principle of all this seems to be sort of an alternative cost-benefit analysis of whether to use one alternative versus the other, to do tree planting versus the refrigeration. Just from a pragmatic standpoint, I just wondered about those two aspects.
Okay, let me try here. Let me point out, if the impact of clean water services had been so significant that they were actually creating a thermal blockage in the river, you know, where the salmon are swimming upstream to try to get to their spawning areas, and they hit the clean water services temperature impact and they stopped dead in their tracks, none of this would have been possible. But it isn't like that. It's actually a pretty small impact. It's very small, and there's no evidence whatsoever for a thermal blockage. So we are not asking clean water services to somehow compensate for the fact that there's going to be this time frame where the trees haven't grown to a significant height yet. Instead, they're agreeing to plant to basically offset double their excess heat load over 20 years, and we're saying okay.
But the actual sort of ideal temperature for the species, would it actually require double the cooling?
The ideal temperature for the species, frankly, is never going to get met. It's not going to get met below the outfall. It's not going to get met above the outfall. It's not going to get met with the planting. It's not going to get met without the planting. It's just we're doing something that's going to make things better. The standard isn't going to get met.
Great, great, great point. Thanks. And a question for Linda real quick. Is she still there? Okay. Just a question in general. Maybe, Sonia, you might be able to answer part of this. I had wondered, I understand that there's been experimentation and implementation of airshed training. Has there been any study of or experimentation with trading between or across sheds, air sheds to watersheds within a geographic area? I'm thinking particularly maybe of sort of deposition, things like that, where there might be some crossovers, or where one particular source of pollutants has air emissions and water emissions issues within a geographic area. Has there been any experimentation to that you're aware of?
I'm not aware of experimentation. I'm aware of talking about it. It's been talked about in the context of mercury. We do have mercury and fish tissue problems in Oregon, as there are in other parts of the country. And we know that the main source of mercury is not, again, sewage treatment plants where we have the best regulatory handle. We understand it to be caused by air deposition. and the burning of fossil fuels. And mercury is present in trace amounts in fossil fuels. It's landing on the ground. It's finding up in the water. It's bioaccumulating in the fish. So I've heard it talked about in that context, but I don't know where it's going to go.
Thank you.
We're going to go, I'm going to go ahead and toss it back. She will be continuing on slide number 73. I'm going to go over the next couple of slides really quickly, because I think we've covered in one way or another through Sonia's presentation or the examples covered before, the benefits of trading. This slide in particular has a couple impressive numbers on it, in terms of cost savings, which is the impetus for trading. I mean, the whole idea of trading came from the notion of getting the same environmental result at lower cost. And when you're looking at watershed scale trading, those costs can be considerable. And the Chesapeake Bay's first example here, the Chesapeake Bay Finance Panel, concluded that, quote, fully leveraged non-point source trading could save an estimated $1 billion, or about 7% of the total cost for 300 wastewater treatment plants to reach the water quality standards in the bay. That would be over a time frame of about 7 to 15 years. The second figure from the Miami River program, which is being developed in Ohio, and this is an estimate that over 20 years for 315 wastewater treatment plants to meet nitrogen and phosphorus criteria could save $370 million. My reason for sharing this, these numbers make economists and others very enthusiastic about trading. They tend to make people who come from resource protection vantage point a little nervous sometimes because they think it's all about the money. And I guess I'd like to share my take on this, which is that we should be trying to achieve our natural resource goals as efficiently as possible. And when you're talking about cost savings this big, you are, in a lot of cases, you might be talking about the difference between achieving water quality improvements and just not, because it's too expensive. So that's why I share this information and the perspective that's one reason I think to be enthusiastic about the cost saving component. And I think we'll just skip on to the second slide. I think we've covered the benefits of non-point source trading. But I wanted to amplify something from Sonia's presentation, which I don't think she mentioned, but we agreed one of us would, so I will, which is when you do a riparian restoration and other land-based best management practices, you often get collateral benefits, in habitat, in co-control of pollutants. You can control sediment pathogens and nutrients all with one practice. So that's another reason that non-point source trading is of interest to some folks. There are also a lot more challenges with non-point source trading, which I'm going to get to in just a minute. But first, I wanted to go to slide 75, where we'll talk about, for a minute, I appreciated Sonia's comments about things that get in the way of trading, and basically any of these, the flip side of any of these points would mean that the trading would not be a very promising approach to meeting water quality goals in the watershed. But we have learned a few lessons based on a number of pilots and projects around the country over the last 15 years about where trading is more likely to be a useful water quality management approach. That is, the water quality problem and the pollutant sources are well characterized. You know what the loadings are and where they're coming from. You have a water quality target in place. We've talked about that. Multiple point sources facing more stringent permit limits. As in the case of Tualatin, you can have one, if you have one motivated point source, you can make it happen. But talking here about watershed scale, the more point sources you have, the more potential buyers you have, the more likely it is that trading might be viable. Significant pollutant control cost differences are a must. And again, with nutrients, this is usually the case, that you will have a big difference between advanced, say, wastewater treatment costs to control nutrients and pretty basic non-point source management practices that are much lower cost. Continuing on page 76, on slide 76, you have to have a fair amount of data in order to trade in a way that takes account of the
equivalency factors that we talked about before. And so you have to have a reasonable amount of data and modeling in order to assess relative impact of trades. Appropriate pollutant type is important. That came up earlier in a question, with trading being easier for pollutants that exert effects over longer times and larger scales. Timing of pollutant reductions has to be able to be aligned. This is something we could talk about for a long time in and of itself. If you have to have, say, in point non-point source trading, you have to have landowners who can get the practices in place and producing within the agreed time frame that the point source has to meet. As Sonia says, that can be negotiated, and sometimes you can negotiate a little longer if you're going to get more for the resource, but the fact is you have to be able to align that. And then finally, you have to have someone at the state level and throughout really the watershed of interest willing to engage and to take what is a non-traditional and in a lot of people's minds sort of a mysterious approach. And that isn't going to happen everywhere. Because, moving to slide 77 now, because it isn't always easy to tell where trading will and won't be a good fit, it's not always straightforward to assess all those factors I just reviewed, EPA published about a year ago this handbook, which I would recommend to you if you're interested in more detail on trading after this call. This was based on a handbook that Claire Sherry of Region 10 developed out in Region 10, and then we made sort of a national version last year, and it covers all the issues, or almost all the issues we've talked about today in terms of environmental equivalence, timing of trades, trading boundaries, avoiding hot spots, and it also has a full section, which we haven't gotten into today at all, on financial attractiveness of trades and how you can kind of get a snapshot of whether you even have enough cost differential to support a trading market. The handbook also covers basic functions of a trading market, which I'm going to review quickly now, starting on slide 78, assuring Clean Water Act compliance, and the book has a written section on each of these areas. So again, if you want more information, trading boundaries, how to define credits, accountability mechanisms for pollutant reductions, avoiding hotspots and ensuring equivalence, enabling communication among credit buyers and sellers, which we haven't talked much about, but which is an essential function of a trading program, and tracking trades and progress, I'm on slide 79 now, towards water quality goals and through monitoring. Managing risk among parties to trade. This actually isn't environmental risk. This is transaction risk. That is the risk that a trade will go bad or that someone's going to be held liable for something they weren't prepared to be held liable for. And an example of this is, acts of nature and a flood coming along and destroying a best management practice that a farmer had put in. It would be well if there was an understanding ahead of time what the conditions and the consequences of that would be to either the credit buyer or the credit seller. One way that trading programs manage risk is for non-point source trades is by identifying the best management practices up front that are eligible and trying to assess the uncertainty associated with them. So that's the kind of risk we're talking about managing here, and that is discussed more in the handbook, and then providing information to and engaging stakeholders in the process and discusses some approaches to that. I am going to just very quickly, I'm going to actually skip slide 80 because I see we're running a little low on time, but I did want to spend just a couple minutes on, we've covered kind of benefits of trading, examples, some of the technical challenges, and I've identified point non-point source trading on a watershed scale as kind of the, you know, an emerging area, if you will, that is being explored in a number of watersheds, and the discussion really isn't complete without being upfront about the challenges that are posed by non-point source trading, and specifically in the area of assessing credits, because it's a lot trickier than for point sources. And the reasons for that are probably evident to you, but the non-point source load estimates and therefore load reduction estimates are a lot less certain than point source loads. They're diffuse. They vary a lot based on the weather, based on soil type, slope, etc. All point source discharges are on a tributary. A non-point source could be inland quite a ways from the water. You have to account for travel of the pollutant load across land and into the water. And then, as we've discussed, the effectiveness of death management practices varies really widely from highly effective, almost measurable, manure management approaches to very, very variable effectiveness in say something, a buffer strip or tillage practices. So all of that makes it, a lot more tricky to get a good estimate of what are the actual pollutant reductions that you're achieving from a non-point source trade. So trading programs have, developed a number of approaches to addressing these, and addressing this uncertainty, I'm going to share a few of those, but I do want to just acknowledge, I think this is still a developing area and one that continues to need, a lot more good thought and implementation, and I think it will get that with a number of programs that are sort of working through these tough issues. Some of the approaches that are being used is, of course, discounting credits. We talked about discounting even point source credits based on location. The same thing would have to be done for non-point sources, but you can also discount them based on the best management practice. Is it a highly efficient one, or is it a more variable one? If more variable, it's going to be discounted more. Trading ratios are used in every point non-point source trading program, requiring at least a 2-to-1 ratio to ensure that the non-point source reduction is really being achieved. Favoring quantified management practices would be one way to go in non-point source trades, or using conservative assumptions about BMP effectiveness. So any and all of those can be used. And in addition, I think we need even better data than we have now on the effectiveness of different practices in retaining nitrogen and phosphorus. The data is quite good on sediment, on soil, because that's what most of the ag tools were based to do. But we need more work in terms of honing them for the nutrients. And that leads to the last point, which is how essential it is to engage agricultural professionals early and often in the design of many point non-point source trading programs. They're really smart and knowledgeable folks. They can serve a lot of roles from defining best management practices to ensuring accountability among their peers out there on the land, and I think a number of programs have found them to be invaluable in that role. I had put in a couple slides here on defining non-point source credits, which I'm thinking we should probably skip over in the interest of time. If this is an area of interest to you, I encourage you to look in the trading handbook. It walks through several very detailed mathematical examples of how you could identify a baseline load for a non-point source, discount it for different management practices, and come up with what would be the number of allocable credits. Another issue, though, that I should touch on, which is here on slide 82, just and again is covered quite thoroughly in the handbook, is that another tricky thing about non-point source trading is what is the baseline. For a point source, if you make a reduction below your waste load allocation, your water quality-based effluent limit, you potentially have credits to sell. Again, the load allocations are more general. In a TMDL, they're applied to a large collection of sources. How do you take that? And EPA's trading policy has said that the load allocation will be the baseline for a non-point source. In other words, they have to meet that first before they can start generating credits. But how do you do that? How do you take a general load allocation and apply it to a specific landowner in a way that's analytically holds muster and also that's fair? Because some landowners are way ahead of others in terms of the practices they already have in place. So that's another fun set of challenging things for folks to figure out as they pursue point non-point source trading. I'm not going to walk through slide 83, which is how the Lower Boise program in Idaho set about defining phosphorus credits from their non-point sources, but again, I recommend the handbook to you if you're interested in more detail there. We're going to move forward past the question slide to slide 85.
And I'm going to close out here with these last couple slides. I appreciated Sonia's comments on the future of trading from her perspective, and I'll offer a complement to that, which is more broad in terms of how many trading, 10 years from now, how many trading programs do we think we'll have. I guess I see there could be a lot, but there's still a lot of uncertainty about when and where trading programs will develop. We've tried to help folks answer that question with the handbook, but there are still the technical challenges, that some of which I just reviewed, that need to be worked through. If we're successful in doing that, trading could potentially be used in a lot of waters. Right now, on the 303D list of impaired waters, there are more than 50,000 waters impaired by excess nutrients. That number is likely to grow in the next few years. As we've discussed, a much smaller subset of those waters are going to be, have conditions that will make trading likely to be useful. That could still be thousands of waters. And again, where those conditions exist and the cost savings are there, trading could go forward. But I say at this point, it's an open question. How much more trading we'll see. We're certainly seeing a lot more engagement in it and interest. The time will tell how many more programs we have. One model, and this is what I'm going to close on, that EPA is interested in pursuing to see how useful it is for point non-point source trading is a model that would use sort of a central banker to facilitate trades. And on slide 86, some of our inspiration, if you will, for this model was wetlands mitigation banking, which for 10 years has used third-party brokers to basically create wetlands that will offset unavoidable permitted wetland impact. And so we started asking ourselves whether this kind of a broker role couldn't also work with especially for point non-point source trading, and that it might be helpful in tackling some of the more challenging aspects of non-point source trading. And in particular, it could help connect what could be dozens or even hundreds of buyers and sellers in a watershed. Most large buyers will need aggregated credits for multiple landowners, just like Clean Water Services is going to be engaging with quite a few farmers, landowners, in order to get the credits, the temperature credits it needs to meet its needs. That's going to be true for most large buyers for nutrients as well. And a broker could help perhaps get the buyers and sellers together. Sonia also mentioned how most farmers, landowners, really don't want to get anywhere near government, yet we do have a need in any trading program for accountability. And so it's possible that kind of a third-party broker could help play the role of making that transaction with farmers while keeping government at its arm's length while still ensuring accountability in the credits. I'm going to move on to, this is just a schematic about how it could work. The South Nation Conservation Program is also, which we already reviewed, is also an example of how this broker function could work. And the broker could be a conservation district, possibly a watershed group. It could be a private credit broker, if you will. In the case of Connecticut, which, again, is just a point source trading program, the broker is the state. Not that I'm necessarily advocating that model, but just to say that a credit broker could be any number of types of entities. And in closing, I guess I would just like to thank you very much for your attention over this sustained period of time. And to echo something that Sonia said, which is that it's really important to engage people, and especially the skeptics, in the early parts of designing a trading program, and that those stakeholders of all kinds can have really good ideas that will affect the outcome of trading programs. And so it's just very important to, I think, look at all possible solutions, including trading, and to look closely at design questions and implementation, and where you have the opportunity to contribute to positive outcomes for trading programs. And that's it. I think we're going to open it up for a final.
Thank you, Linda. We do have a few minutes to answer additional questions. However, one thing I'd like to first do is draw everyone's attention to where they can go to obtain Linda's and Sonia's contact information. If you're online, you simply click on the home icon at the top, and it brings you
back to the homepage, which has Linda's and Sonia's email addresses and phone numbers. And at the bottom, I do want to draw your attention to two things. One is a link to additional resources, and the second is a seminar feedback form. I'd like to remind everyone to please consider filling it out as we do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve our webcast. Also, one last thing on the links to additional resources today. We have links to resources such as EPA's Water Quality Trading website, EPA's Water Quality Trading Assessment Handbook, which Linda had mentioned earlier, and let's see here, we've got Oregon Department of Environmental Quality Water Quality Credit Training website, and we've got a few others, so I do want to let folks know that there are several other resources available, and I want to bring attention to them. Now, we do have additional time for people to ask questions, but let me go ahead and turn it to a question that we have on the online. And this one is actually directed at Sonia, which is from Ohio, who asks, where is Clean Water Services getting the money to pay for easements? And
where are they getting money to pay for easements? From their ratepayers. It's the sewerage agency. So if people in Washington County, which is the area it serves, pay their sewerage bill, and that money goes to Clean Water Services, and part of it's going to fund this work.
Yeah, so it's pretty sure. Yeah.
Did you get the answer?
That's good.
Great. Are there other questions on the phone lines for either Sonia or Linda?
I have a quick question about the SNC example. The dischargers there were paying to into SNC, and then SNC was using that money on BMPs. Do you know how the amount, the payment amount was set for the discharger to pay to SNC? And then also, did the farmers who were implementing the BMPs have to sign a binding agreement to retain those BMPs for a certain period of time?
I'm sorry, is that question directed at me, Sonia?
No, it was about the Ontario example.
Oh, good, okay, thank you.
Sorry.
Hi, yeah, this is Linda. Good question. The terms of, yes, there is an ongoing operations and maintenance agreement that has to be maintained by each of the landowners, and that's a very good question and a really important consideration for any trading program that's relying on best management practices. It's one thing to get them in place, quite another thing to make sure they operate well for years to come. In terms of the money, I don't have a good answer for you on the cost. I know they did detailed cost estimates of, you know, cost per kilogram of total phosphorus controlled by various BMPs, and I'm guessing they probably averaged that out, and then that's what they charged to the point sources, but I don't know for sure. If you want to send me an email, I can give you the contact of Dennis O'Grady in South Nation Conservation Authority, and you could posit that question to him.
Well, in the interest of time, I'd like to conclude today's webcast, and I'd especially like to thank Linda and Sonia for presenting today, and of course, thanks to everyone who joined us. We do encourage folks to return to the www.epa.gov/watershedforum for upcoming webcasts. And that officially ends our webcast for today. Thanks again to everyone for joining us.